This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for March 11th, 2013. Here's a brief summary of what's in store. Our first item is Citywide Transit, a decision of the Second Circuit extending the statute of limitations for fraud based on the fraud of the accountant, not the client. Then an Ernst & Young agreement to pay $123 million in fines to settle tax shelter investigation. You may recall that several of their partners were convicted of criminal fraud by a jury in Manhattan a couple of years ago. The proposed regulations on the health insurance provider fees are out. Now, you may not be a health insurance provider, but it may be very interesting to you how this all gets sorted out. A corporation's recognized built-in loss not permitted to be treated as a separate NOL, and then a field attorney advisory directly conflicting with one we talked about last week. Remember, last week we talked about a field attorney advisory that said a bank's other real estate owned was subject to 263 Cap A if the bank incurred expenses to maintain it. This week, we have a general legal advice that says the other real estate owned is not subject to 263 Cap A, which is what makes tax practice so interesting, right? And then we have a couple that were deceived, defrauded by a construction company, permitted to claim a theft loss, and the facts of that are very interesting, an extension of the certification period for the work opportunity credit, a very interesting field attorney advisory in which the IRS, to its own attorneys, in a carefully structured transaction, told the IRS attorneys that judicial doctrines such as step transaction should not be applied to deny the taxpayer the benefit of deferred gain recognition, and that's because of a particular quirk in the statute that the taxpayer took advantage of. We'll talk some more about that. Then a field attorney advisory explaining when a corporation that gets a loan from a state, an industrial development loan, is required to include the proceeds of that loan in income. And finally, another 263A ruling. We haven't seen many of those. It seems like we've had several the past few weeks regarding the capitalization of minimum royalties. So let's begin with Citywide Transit, a decision of the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit reversed the tax court in this matter, finding that the IRS could collect unpaid employment taxes from a corporation because the company's accountant had filed fraudulent tax returns to embezzle funds and evade taxes owed to the Internal Revenue Service. That meant that the assessments against the corporation were timely, even though the taxes were from 97, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003. The examination did not begin until 2004. The tax court had ruled the assessments were untimely, finding that there was no evidence the accountant had intended to evade the payment or the collection of taxes. That was a ruling I recall reading and thinking it was absurd at the time. The court said tax evasion was only an incidental consequence of the embezzlement scheme. The Second Circuit said, number one, an underpayment existed. Number two, fraud existed. Number three, the accountant had intended to evade taxes. Number four, the tax evasion was not merely an incidental consequence of the embezzlement. And finally, it was of no consequence that the accountant evaded the taxes for his own benefit and not the corporation's. Code Section 6501(c)(1) provides for the assessment of tax at any time if fraudulent returns have been filed with the intent to evade tax and the accountant's fraudulent conduct extended the statute of limitations and permitted the government to go after the client for the unpaid taxes. This was not an employee, by the way, of the corporation. This was an outside accountant. A just very interesting case to read if you're interested at all in those circumstances where the statute of limitations gets extended. Item number two, one of those events that rattles around, bringing to a close a shameful chapter in the history of our profession, in which partners and managers in the largest, supposedly the most reputable CPA firms, became involved in bogus tax shelters. This decision, March the 4th, 2013, or this news item, Ernst & Young has agreed to pay $123 million to settle tax shelter claims. The firm admits wrongful conduct by partners and employees. By the way, those partners have already been convicted of wrongful conduct, the non-prosecution agreement that they negotiated here applies only to the firm, not to any individuals. And so the firm has thrown all of the individuals who may have been involved in these schemes under the bus, paid $123 million, and agreed not to engage in that kind of conduct in the future. In fact, the firm has been cooperating with the tax shelter fraud investigation since 2003. I don't suppose this is a tax matter. In fact, I'm pretty sure it isn't, or maybe it is. Let's see. We're talking here about Section 9010 of the Affordable Care Act, which requires an annual health insurance provider fee to be paid by corporations that provide health insurance. This only applies to covered entities with net premiums written in excess of $25 million. So small health insurance companies are exempted. But this annual fee applies to each covered entity engaged in the business of providing health insurance. The annual fee is an amount set by Congress, and the amount of the annual fee is a portion among all of the covered entities based on the proportion of health insurance premiums they collected to the total health insurance premiums collected by all covered entities. The covered entities report on a Form 8963, Report of Health Insurance Provider Information. The IRS totals up all of the health insurance premiums, and they will then determine the net premiums written based on the reports that are submitted by all the covered entities and any other source of information available. And then in each fee year, the IRS will send each covered entity a notice of preliminary fee calculation. Now, those fees are coming out of the insurance premiums collected by the health insurers. One would have to wonder if the government's dipping its hand into the till here isn't going to effectively increase the cost of health insurance somewhere in the process. It remains to be seen how all this is going to work. But if you are interested, we have proposed regulations published on March the 4th, and these regulations implement Section 9010 of the Affordable Care Act. That did not change the Internal Revenue Code. And by the way, the statute and the proposed regulations treat this fee as an excise tax, to which only civil actions for refund apply, and the fee is treated as being described in Code Section 275A6, for which no deduction is allowed. So this fee is mandated by the federal government. It is apportioned among all the riders of health insurance that take in more than $25 million, and that would be most of the big ones, and it is not deductible in determining their federal taxable income. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Next, we have Internal Legal Memorandum 2013-09013, in which the IRS concludes that Section 382 does not treat a recognized built-in loss as a net operating loss for the year in a determination separate from the annual tax computation for that year under Section 63A and 172C. The taxpayer's position in this matter is that if the taxpayer had positive taxable income apart from the recognized built-in loss, they would treat the recognized built-in loss as an NOL carryforward, thereby offsetting the positive taxable income subject to the Section 382 limitation. If the limitation prevented using some of the recognized built-in loss in that year, the disallowed part would carry over to the next year. The IRS, however, concludes that legislators did not intend to allow a recognized built-in loss to escape the Section 382 limitation just because it was recognized after an ownership change, and that no special computation of taxable income or loss under Section 382 applies to recognized built-in losses. Instead, Section 382H4 provides that excess recognized built-in losses would be disallowed as a deduction, making that portion within the limitation an allowed deduction and providing the disallowed deduction to be carried to the next tax year in the same manner as an NOL carry forward. If the recognized built-in loss were a separately determined NOL, that provision in the statute would have been unnecessary. Now, last week, I reported Field Attorney Advisory 2012-3201, which was published eventually on February the 25th, 2013, in which the IRS concluded that direct costs and an allocable share of indirect costs associated with the other real estate owned, that is, property repossessed by a bank, were incurred in connection with property held for resale and therefore had to be capitalized. In Attorney's Memorandum 2013-001, the IRS holds just the opposite. In determining whether property is acquired for resale, a special rule applies to banks that originate loans. Now here, I think they're dead wrong, by the way. Under Regulation Section 263, Cap A1, B13, the origination of loans is not considered the acquisition of property for resale. Well, selling, foreclosed, and the rule goes on to say that notwithstanding the frequency with which the taxpayer sells loans it originates, or the percentage of its originated loans that it sells. So the IRS looks to a provision in the statute that deals with the origination of loans and the sale of loans and tries to extrapolate that to selling foreclosed property. I think the first attorney's memorandum is correct. The second one is wrong. But it is exactly this kind of conflict, of course, that makes tax practice interesting. So pick one. Pick whatever suits your fancy. But then you're going to have to support that as having substantial authority, or perhaps just as giving you a reasonable basis. But you can't do that based on one memorandum or one item. You're going to have to do some additional research to fill in around those particular attorney memorandums. Whichever one you pick, you're going to have to do some additional research to support your position. Next, we have TC Memo 2013-66, James N. Ertis. A construction company misused the funds that Mr. and Mrs. Ertis paid for an addition on their home, misrepresented the status of the job, and the events that followed entitled the couple to a theft loss deduction in 2007, not in 2006, as the IRS argued. And this is important. It's important for us to remember that the year in which we claim the losses, that when we claim losses, we're going to have to support that is the correct year to claim the losses. Here are some of the facts. Mr. and Mrs. Ertis made payments to Onyx Construction, a construction company owned by one Mr. Potok. Construction was running behind schedule. Potok was making excuses and needing additional money when he dropped dead at the age of 30. The petitioners, the taxpayers, became aware of his death, and they went to the wake to try to find out what was going to happen with regard to the construction in progress. They weren't able to live in their home. They had moved out of the home during the remodeling process. At the wake, they discovered that Potok had not been paying his subcontractors. He was involved in other construction projects that were in financial difficulty, and they came to understand that Mr. Potok had died at the age of 30 directly as a result of a drug problem. They then later became aware that he had used portions of the payments they made for expenses unrelated to their construction project, and that the construction company had in fact damaged some of their property during construction. At this point now, they have two claims, and I want to make very clear how important that's going to become. They knew that Potok had insurance, that Onyx Construction had insurance. They filed an insurance claim for the damage to their home, and they then claimed a theft loss deduction on their 2007 return for the money that was obviously gone in Potok's early death. The Potok died on July 29th, 2006. Onyx Construction was involuntarily dissolved on April the 13th, 2007. There was no money, no funds. It was a no-asset bankruptcy. They checked several times to determine whether an estate had been established. None had been established, nor had a will been probated as of April the 1st, 2010. So they claimed a theft loss in 2007. They continued their litigation against the insurance company for the damages to their home, ultimately accepting a settlement. But that issue was in litigation until 2009. Now, the taxpayers claimed the loss in 2007. Here comes the IRS. They say the taxpayers should have claimed their loss in 2006 when Potok died. But they were unable, really, to establish all of the facts necessary to determine the loss until Onyx Construction was involuntarily dissolved. So the taxpayers carry the day. They are entitled to their theft loss. And remember, it was really important that the taxpayers were not continuing to litigate the matter of the loss related to Potok's misuse of their funds. That was over and done. They were continuing to litigate a claim for damage to the rest of the house that was not supposedly part of the remodeling project. Next, we have Notice 2013-14, in which the IRS issues guidance providing employers that hire members of targeted groups additional time beyond the 28-day deadline for submitting Form 8850, the pre-screening notice and certification request for the work opportunity credit. Because the work opportunity credit was extended retroactively for 2012, late at night on December the 31st, 2012, for members of targeted groups, the IRS believes that it is going to be useful to extend the deadline for filing the completed Forms 8850 for those persons who were hired before April 1st, 2013, after December 31st, 2011, until April 29th, 2013. So those employers who hire members of a targeted group after December 31st, 2011 and before April 1st, 2013 will be considered to have satisfied the requirements of Section 51, D13A, 2 little I, if the employer submits the completed Form 8850 no later than April 29th, 2013. So the entire year of 2012 plus the first 3 months of 2013, you have until April the 29th of 2013 to file your completed Form 8850 and claim the work opportunity credit. Next, we have Field Advisory 2012-3401F, in which the IRS tells its employees that the substance over form and step transaction doctrines should not be applied to prevent a taxpayer from deferring gain recognition. This is a very sophisticated plan, sophisticated transaction involving timberlands. The taxpayer engaged in a series of transactions that allowed it to defer recognition of gain from a sale while obtaining an amount approximately equal to the sale's proceeds through a loan, partly by applying the installment sale method and partly by pledging the installment sale notes. The IRS determined that the substance of the transaction was consistent with its form, the transaction altered the party's economic interests, and that each step of the transaction, in fact, had independent economic significance. But what makes the thing work is that ultimately the property involved was farm property. Here's the definition of farm. Section 2032 AE4 says the term farm includes stock, dairy, poultry, fruit, fur-bearing animals, truck farms, plantations, ranches, nurseries, ranges, greenhouses, orchards, and woodlands. Section 2032 AE5 says that farming purposes means cultivating the soil, raising or harvesting any agriculture or horticultural commodity on a farm, handling, drying, packing, grading, storing, etc., and the planting, cultivating, caring for, or cutting of trees. So we've got all these woodlands are farms. Section 453 Cap AD provides that if an installment obligation is pledged to secure a loan or other indebtedness, the receipt of the proceeds from the indebtedness is treated as a payment on the installment obligation. I know that, right? However, what I did not know, and I should have known, is that 453 Cap A B3B provides an exception. If you sell farm property on the installment basis and you pledge that installment note as collateral for a loan, you do not treat that as a payment on the indebtedness, and that's what made that particular plan work. It's an odd situation, it's an exception, but in tax practice, we learn and we get strong by understanding the exceptions as well as the rules. Next, we have another field attorney advisory dealing with when a corporation which receives an industrial development loan from a state, the terms of which provide the loan will be forgiven if the corporation meets certain employment targets, when that's includable in income. In this field attorney advisory, the IRS concludes that loan proceeds a corporation receives from a state that will be wholly or at least partially canceled depending on whether the corporation creates a specified number of jobs will be included in the corporation's income when the all events test is met. The conclusion is that in the circumstances given, the taxpayer does not report income until the all events test under Section 451 is met, no earlier than, and it gave a specific date which was redacted. So the law here, and I think it's particularly useful to review Treasury Regulation 1.451-1A, says that an accrual method taxpayer must meet a two-prong all-events test to determine when income is includable in gross income. So the all-events test provides that income is includable when, one, all events have occurred which fix a right to receive the income, and two, the amount can be determined with reasonable accuracy. The events that fix the right to receive income generally occur when, one, the taxpayer earns the payment through performance, two, the payment is due to the taxpayer, or three, the taxpayer receives the payment, whichever happens first. The question then is this a true loan? And the loan was drafted in such a way that interest would accrue, that the interest in principal would be due on a certain date, and there was no relief from the loan unless the taxpayer had met the employment targets. If the taxpayer met the employment targets, then the loan principal and the interest would be forgiven. At that time, the taxpayer would recognize income. Finally, another field attorney advisory, proliferation of those this week, in which the IRS concludes that minimum royalties must be capitalized. Now, this is true even if the per item royalties exceed the minimum. The taxpayer had entered into a license agreement that required it to make different types of payments for the rights to produce a certain product. The minimum royalty payments are a fixed annual amount, while the earned royalty payments are computed based on the number of units sold or leased that use the particular technology that's under license. When the earned royalties exceed the minimum royalty, arguably there is no minimum royalty, which was the taxpayer's position. But the IRS concluded that earned royalties exceeding the minimum royalty are based on units sold. They are sales-based royalties that can be deducted. However, the minimum royalty payments are clearly capitalizable under the current and the proposed versions of Regulation Section 1.263 Cap A-1E3iu, which is a pretty deep citation, and that provides that capitalizable costs include any minimum annual payments incurred by the licensee, the taxpayer, and I think I would have argued the taxpayer's position that no minimum royalties were paid because the earned royalties surpassed the minimum royalty threshold. The IRS disagreed, and the IRS says that although the earned royalty payments were applied toward the minimum liability payment until that liability was satisfied, the taxpayer was still liable for the minimum royalty regardless of whether the amount of earned royalty payments exceeded the minimum or not. Now, this is the IRS's opinion. I clearly do not agree with this one, and taxpayer could certainly take a position contrary to the position in the field attorney advisory, since that interpretation of the regulation could be well beyond a reasonable interpretation. I think we need to, I would love to have the tax court take a look at that particular interpretation. And so if I could find a client that wanted to go do battle and pay me for it, we'd be happy to do that. Well, thank you again for joining me in these weekly discussions. One of the bad things about this is I don't get any feedback. So if you enjoy the weekly tax podcast, send an email to lynn@npcpe.net. That's lynn@npcpe.net. And let me know that they're useful. Thanks. Stay safe.